I am with AARP, and so I guess I'm sort of focusing on the elderly, but that's 50-plus, and I don't think a lot of people who are 50 think of themselves as elderly. But it is the older cohort and those who may at least begin to be thinking, like, about retirement. I must admit, when I got out of college, I couldn't imagine myself as I am now. I think that's a big stretch, although I think it's very interesting to think of oneself as an older person being the other or the same person. But I think part of what I want to look at is how we make decisions over a lifetime that will give us a more or less secure retirement income when we get to that point of view, that point now. Let me see. Right. Next one. No, I don't want to do that. Oops. How do I get out of this? I better look at this. Oh, I see. Okay. This may be. This just says what the AARP Public Policy Institute's about. I don't think it's. I don't want to take time there. I think as we look at retirement income, Social Security was a foundation of retirement income, but it was certainly never expected to be the sole source of income, although it is now for many people. We also have seen, we've been talking about consumer decision-making in one way or another. Consumers didn't used to have to make a lot of decisions. We look at the decline of the tradition-defined benefit plan, which provided a lifetime income, a fixed benefit, and it was automatic. You didn't have, in most cases, you were just part of the pension plan where you worked, provided you had an employer that provided one. And this just shows, beginning in the 1990, the decline as a percentage of the workforce of the defined benefit plans and the increase in the defined contribution plans. But of course, as we can see, there are many working people who don't have either. We also had sort of another retirement income, our home savings account, not that we necessarily thought of it that way. People had their mortgage more or less paid off by retirement. It could be annuitized, to say a reverse mortgage, or it could be sold to support retirement needs or just be a rent-free place to live. In many cases, that's no longer the case. Many mortgages are not typically repaid by retirement. The home has been used as an ATM for all kinds of things. And in some cases, now it's a liability and not an asset. So that, as a foundation of retirement security, is much less available today. So basically, we have do-it-yourself retirement. I don't think I skipped a thing. Make sure of that. But anyway. So it begins with the youth, in one sense. Where do you bank or borrow? This goes to the underserved, the unbanked, which I think is also a concern of AARP's. But I'm not going to go into it in depth this time. How you use your credit cards. College expenses. This is both for yourself and your children. I mean, some people amortize their college expenses over a 30-year period because that's all they can afford. And then for their children, so they make those decisions. Housing expenses, how much are you going to spend on your housing, on your mortgage? You have to make a decision to save in a 401k or perhaps outside of the employment context. You have to make, when you save something, you have to make investment choices while you're working. How are you going to get this, what you save, to grow? And then spending and investing once you're retired. So suddenly, when we talk about financial literacy, we talk about choice architecture, this kind of thing, it is really important because in all these cases, people are really making choices. And I'm going to talk a little bit about maybe there are some ways that we can nudge them into what I guess I would say are more prudent choices, and through regulation and in other ways. But we've had financial products, I think we all know, that have been a real obstacle. We've had unpredictable and unsuitable mortgage products, hidden fee credit cards, bank overdraft programs, the alternative financial services industry with very short repayment periods and very high multiple rollovers. We have a very complex investment annuities. These are things that make it very hard for people to make prudent decisions. And as we look at this and decide on what subjects we're going to research, I think a lot of it, particularly on the disclosure, has been, well, let's look at what's effective disclosure for the product and have a financially literate consumer, as if, you know, that's that part of the triangle is all you're worrying about. As I think we've brought up today, not only getting a financially literate consumer, but a consumer that can set long-term goals. How is this going to affect me in the future? I think in terms of, I'll now use this great word, which I now like, choice architecture, how do we get a suitable product, or at least a product that's suitable for most people? That doesn't mean you couldn't possibly go outside of it, so that it's easier for a consumer to understand the choices they're making and perhaps encourages them to make a more prudent choice, which actually also supports the overall financial system and the economy, because I think some of the unsuitable choices, the victimization of the people, ended up being the sources of instability in our economy. And no hidden traps. But we also have, in many cases, not all cases, a third person in there. And this is either your investment advisor or the salesperson. And no matter what we do about literacy and disclosure, we have to wonder how this person is going to be part of the equation. A salesperson, they need to have expertise through licensing. They should be acting in the best interest of the customer, and they should disclose any conflicts, because they have a relationship often with the product producer. So as we look at these things, it's not, and I'm not disparaging all the work that everybody's doing on disclosure, because I think it's terribly important, but as we look at research, I think we have to look at this sort of triangle and recognize that, you know, you can have the best disclosure in the world and even a financially literate consumer. If you have a really good personable salesperson who just wants to make a sale, it's a little bit like, and I know there was some FDA guy here, like the Lunesta moth while going across while they're talking about all the side effects of the drug, or or Sally Field, you know, patting her dog, you know, while all the side effects are described. You know, it's how do you deal with that? And part of it may be through regulation of that particular person and what they can do, but that's a human being too. So as we look, and I am not a person that designs these studies and these things, which I think are really great and will help to inform our debate, but hopefully they'll look at this fairly complicated product and also look at various policy and regulatory responses, which I think has been done with the Dodd-Frank bill, but we will see as it is implemented. And I thought I would look, I was going to just look at mortgage products briefly, because I'm not going to have a chance to go into all the types of products. And we know how bad they were on lifetime income, so I won't spend long on this, but we did do a study at AARP, and it showed that borrowers 50-plus made up 28% of all foreclosures in 2007. We haven't had the money to update that, but it is a significant problem for people over 50 as it is for people under 50. With mortgage products, I mean, they really tried to set it up so there would be no hidden traps, or fewer hidden traps, maybe I should say. It's specific limitations on certain provisions, balloon payments, negative amortization, prepayment penalties. So they basically said you can't do this, or if you do this, there are other hoops you have to go through. They also had the skin in the game securitization, which basically says that if you sell, say, a mortgage into as a security or securitize it, you have to keep 5% of the risk. But there is an exception to that, which is a qualified residential mortgage. My feeling, and maybe I'm wrong, is that the definition of the qualified residential mortgage will act as a mortgage template. I know we're not supposed to say plain vanilla, but maybe we'll have some kind of template of plain vanilla mortgages, which really will make it easier, will make fewer choices for the consumer, and the consumer can, you know, have the choices, and it will be make it easier for the disclosure and for the consumer to make the decisions. And hopefully we will nudge consumers a little bit in terms of being prudent by requiring documentation of ability to repay and maybe even return to debt-to-income ratios. I'm not predicting that, but they seem sensible to me when I was a lot younger, and future GSE reform. So the mortgage products, I think there will be changes. Not that there won't be, you know, unusual ones, but they'll be sort of the outliers in the market. The mortgage sales persons, there is increased regulation of them, licensure, state and federal. There's a prohibition on these wonderful things we discussed earlier, these yield spread premiums. And they basically have to offer a fair loan that the borrower understands and is reasonably likely to be able to repay. And I'm sure there are going to be regulations around that. But that relationship is so important in most transactions that I think, in all probability, disclosure will not be enough. I think it will, there will have to be regulation. And also the consumer decisions, the Consumer Financial Protection Board, a sort of uniform fact box, which I think is Gene's term, maybe something like total annual loan cost. I'm not sure exactly how you want to do it, so that people really understand the costs of these mortgages. I think there's a challenge for financial education because of the consumer's understanding. They lack knowledge, but also I've found consumers lack confidence. Often they have this nagging question, but they think, people will think I'm stupid if I ask it, or it's really that I don't know what I'm talking about, so therefore I better not ask a question, which occurs to me. So I think in terms of financial education, one is to empower the consumer to ask questions, any question that they think is relevant to them. And, of course, what are the consumer goals? How is this mortgage decision going to affect their lifetime income? With credit cards, again, there's a lot that's the same. I don't think it's going to keep people from overusing credit cards. In that case, it's really the consumer and the product. You don't have somebody in the middle, such as an advisor or a salesperson. You really have the consumer and the product. I think the CARD Act has made a lot of steps forward, but in effect, I think financial education is going to be very powerful and maybe the most powerful tool that we'll have to try and educate the consumer so they don't get this get themselves in this cycle of debt. I heard this 70% have maxed out their credit cards. I mean, that's still pretty scary, and hopefully as more people get jobs that we can begin to get back to some kind of sanity. In the do-it-yourself retirement, now the individual must decide to save and how much. They have to, not only do they have to overcome with, I want to buy this now and I need to save, they have to overcome inertia and procrastination. They're much more likely to save at work through payroll deduction than on their own. So you see that there are lots of people that don't have easy access. They'd have to make the effort to go in and open an IRA. And unfortunately, most of them don't. They have to make investment choices. Most people need some kind of advice to frame these choices. Employers can provide written materials and offer expert advice. They've also found, again, this is how you can frame decisions, that automatic enrollment boosts the rate of plan participation substantially in 401ks. In other words, the worker is automatically opt-in unless they decide to opt out. And they found over time, at least the studies, that those who are automatically enrolled are no more likely to disenroll than those who actually signed up for it. And also that this automatic enrollment boosts the participation of the people who are least likely to participate. There's an auto IRA proposal which would expand saving to more businesses and their employees by setting up a system requiring businesses to offer an auto IRA in a relatively cheap way to do it. It hasn't gotten too far in the Congress, but given how close to 60% of people don't work in businesses that offer any kind of pension plan, that would be quite helpful. And then as we go into the investment decisions that you have to make, and you have this same triangle to worry about, and particularly often the investment advisor, who may not be a salesperson or may if they're with a brokerage, is very important in helping the consumer to, one, make a decision at all, and two, to make a decision that may comport with their long-term goals. Employers provide a range of choices and information. They provide a default investment. Now it's often a target date fund based on the person's age. But individuals should review their investment choices regularly. And they often need personalized investment advisors to make choices for them. So one of the things is, how do people choose an advisor? That may be something for consumer research. And the duty and expertise of an advisor. The SEC is going to be looking at expanding the concept of fiduciary duty to people that were to brokers as opposed to just investment advisors. That's a regulatory response, but I think there's also ways to look at how should an individual choose an advisor. At retirement, you're choosing two things. You're choosing how to keep investing, because most likely you're going to live for a while longer, and that's you have a bewildering choice of options. And you have a need for trusted expert advice. Again, defined benefit plans would just pay you a fixed stream of income. In other words, automatically annuitize. Defined contribution plans usually pay out a lump sum on retirement, and rarely a choice at that moment of an annuity or even to annuitize a portion of the amount due, which the employer sets up for you. I think there have been issues about fiduciary duty, you know, what happens if the insurance company goes belly up, and other things that employers have not been doing that. They would be in a better position to maybe make good choices for an employee, but they no longer, in most cases, they no longer offer that. So suddenly you get to retirement, and you're offered this big pot of money, and what do you do with it? Do you annuitize it or not? Payouts can be structured to last a lifetime or lifetimes, which is great as a protection for running out of money. It disciplines spending, but it's not for everyone. You need a certain amount of liquidity. You need money for emergencies. Maybe you have enough Social Security and defined benefit plans from another job, or maybe you want to really try and leave as much money as you can to your heirs or to whoever you want to leave it to. Other issues as we look at do-it-yourself retirement obviously involve diminished capacity. More and more people, as they get older, you'll have people, they may not be incompetent, but they begin to show diminished capacity, whether from Alzheimer's or other aspects. And, of course, fraud, which is of particular concern, I think, for seniors, since they seem to be most often the targets and seem to be more susceptible to it. So I've tried very briefly to outline many issues for research. And I think some of this has already been going on. I guess this shows something of a bias that I don't think that disclosure and financial literacy are going to go all the way there, as important as they are. I think we need to frame the choices, i.e. what products are routinely available in the market, so that we will enable consumers to make better decisions in their own best interest. Anyway, thank you.